Did you happen to bring along any of those chocolate mousse cake thingies? Cadogan House was a historic Hyde Park mansion turned vampire dorm, a restored beauty. Navarre House, on the other hand, was big and garishly white and took up the corner of one of the city's most expensive chunks of real estate. It was 4 stories tall and was marked by a giant turret at the corner, the entire facade wrapped in the same white marble. "I think their turret is bigger than our turret," I said as Ethan pulled up to the curb. "Selena always had a flair for the dramatic," he agreed. I put a hand on his arm as we walked to the front door, which was all but hidden from the street by massive, leafy trees. He stopped and glanced down at my hand, then up at me. "One of our disagreements, Morgan and me." I picked over my words, trying to figure out a way to explain without being too, to use Lindsay's word, anatomical. "Morgan thought you and I were involved. Previously, I mean." I stopped there, hoping Ethan got the point so I wouldn't have to spell out exactly what Morgan had accused me of doing with Ethan. "Ah," he said. "I see." "We weren't, of course, but he wouldn't be convinced. So in addition to the other reasons he won't be happy to see me, he may not be thrilled to see me with you." Ethan gave a half snort, then walked up the stairs. Without so much as knocking, he opened the front door and beckoned me inside. "What's funny?" I asked when I reached him. "The irony, by accusing you of such wanton acts, he accomplished the very thing he sought to avoid." "I'm not sure I'd say wanton." Ethan leaned in, his lips at my ear. "I, Merritt, would definitely say wanton." I couldn't stop the grin that lifted a corner of my mouth, or the blush that warmed my cheeks. "Besides," Ethan whispered, following me into the house, "I've decided that if the Sun-Times story doesn't top his list of things to accuse us of today, there is less hope for his skills as a master than I might have imagined." There had been no security outside the door of Navarre House, no 10-foot-high gate, no mercenary fairies keeping a watchful eye on the premises. Navarre vamps saved that fun for the foyer. But the guards weren't the beefy types I expected. 3 women sat behind a semicircular reception desk made of glass and steel that was perched just inside the entrance. Each woman was posed in front of a sleek computer monitor. They all had dark hair and big brown eyes, and they all wore fitted white suit jackets. Each wore her hair up, but in a different style. From left to right, funky bouffant, ponytail, and tidy bun. They glanced up as we entered, then began to whisper and click keys on the respective keyboards. "I assume these are the gatekeepers?" I silently asked. "Might as well be the Greek fates," he replied. "Name?" said the one in the middle, looking up from the monitor to gaze suspiciously at us. "Ethan Sullivan, Master, Cadogan House," Ethan said. "Merritt, Sentinel, Cadogan House." The other 2 women stopped typing and looked at me. Their expressions showed a range of emotions: disgust, curiosity, sheer feminine appraisal. All emotions, I assumed, motivated by the run-ins I'd had with their former master, Selena, and their current one, Morgan. I was 0 for 2 in terms of Navarre masters. "Identification," said the woman closest to Ethan. He reached inside his suit jacket and pulled a card from the interior pocket. Then with 2 fingers handed it to the woman. She glanced at it, then began typing in earnest. Thinking we were going to be here for a while, I took the opportunity to scope out the digs and was surprised. The open front room was huge, 2 staircases meeting at a 2nd-floor balcony. The entire atrium was open to the roof, the room topped by a greenhouse-like cage of Victorian skylights. Although those things seemed pretty European to me, the decor looked as if it had been taken from a modern art museum. There wasn't much in the way of furniture or knickknacks, and the few pieces there were had a sculptural quality. There was a white-tufted leather sofa, a coffee table that consisted of a giant curvaceous core of lacquered wood, and recessed lighting shining onto giant canvases of black and white photography and pop art. All of it was set amongst gleaming white marble floors and equally white walls. "This is," I began, my gaze on a painting that looked to represent those rubbery grips that fit on number two pencils, but I found no words to describe it.
"Yes," Ethan said, "it most definitely is."
He shifted beside me, probably not accustomed to waiting for service, then glanced down at the girls again.
"We are expected."
Without looking up, the girl in the middle pointed a long-nailed finger behind us. We both turned. A bench sat in an alcove beside the front door, three bored-looking, supernaturally attractive vampires filling it, two women and a man in between them. They all wore suits and had briefcases across their laps. They were all perfectly polished, but there was a weariness in their eyes and in the slump of their shoulders. They looked as if they'd been here a while.
"Fabulous," I muttered.
Ethan blew out a breath, but his smile was back when he turned to face the fates again.
"At your convenience," he grandly said.
As it turned out, their convenience was 7 minutes later.
"Merritt," the girl on the right finally said.
I looked down at her extended hand, which held a translucent plastic badge the size of a credit card. It had "visitor" stamped across one side and bore a hologram of a wide-winged bee. A symbol of the house's French roots, I thought, but rendered in 21st century technology.
"Fancy," I said, then clipped the badge onto the bottom hem of my shirt. "We have visitor passes as well," Ethan muttered, as if offended by the possibility that Navarre House was more organized or more exclusive than we were. He accepted a clip and added it to his suit, then looked at the women expectantly.
"Silence."
He gestured toward the staircase.
"Should we just—"
"Nadia will be down to retrieve you," said the one in the middle.
"We appreciate your assistance," Ethan said, then moved into the room's main space.
"We need a four-story atrium," I told him.
"Cadogan House is perfect as it is. We're not changing it to fit the fancies of an architecturally jealous sentinel."
"Ah," he added brightly, "here she is." I glanced up. A woman was trotting down the stairway, one delicate hand on the marble banister as she glided toward us.
No, not just a woman, a supermodel. She was all effortless beauty. Her eyes were wide and green, her nose thin and straight, her cheekbones high. Her body was long and lean, and she wore leggings, knee-high boots, and a long, belted knit top. It was the kind of outfit I might have worn while traipsing through the streets of Manhattan during my college days. Her hair was long and medium brown, and it spilled across her shoulders like silk. I leaned in toward Ethan. You might have filled me in on the fact that Morgan's new second was practically a cover girl.
Jealous again?
Not even slightly, I crisply answered, then elbowed him in the ribs. But you're panting, Sullivan. He offered a fake oof at the elbowing, then, hand outstretched, walked toward Nadia.
Ethan, Nadia said with a beatific smile, taking his hand.
They exchanged cheek-to-cheek kisses and whispers that made something turn in my belly. That would be the jealousy kicking in, I silently thought.
Nadia, this is Merritt, my sentinel, he said, gesturing at me.
Nadia beamed at me, then held out both hands.
Merritt, she intoned, leaning in to kiss my cheek as well. It is lovely to meet you.
Her voice carried the faintest French accent, and her perfume was exotic. Equally complex and old-fashioned. Like something you'd pick up in a boutique in a forgotten Parisian arrondissement. It sang of flowers and lemon and rich spice and sunlight, all bottled together.
My liege is in his office, if you'll follow me.
Ethan nodded and fell in line behind Nadia, who trotted back up the stairs, her hair bouncing on her shoulders as she moved. Really, it was like watching a shampoo commercial. At the top of the staircase, we turned to the left, then took a wide marble hallway another 20 or 30 feet. The door was open. I blew out a breath and readied myself for drama.
Chapter 10. My ex-boyfriend's back. Morgan's office was a wide rectangular room that overlooked Navarre House's back courtyard, a small but well-tended space that must have been wedged into the notch between the buildings on the block. The entire back wall was a sheet of glass, the garden below well lit to provide the master a view of the space, and to provide any Navarre vampires in the space a view of their master. It was definitely Selena's kind of architecture, her office a stage for the audience of vampires in the garden below. Tall panels of crimson silk hung at each end of the window, probably to be drawn forward during the daylight hours. The rest of the office was sleek and modern and much less feminine. At one end of the room sat a glass desk, upon which perched a white computer and an array of white desk accessories. Two ultra-modern black and steel chairs sat in front of it, and a seating area of modern furniture my parents probably would have liked, good lines but not very comfortable looking, sat at the other end of the room. The office was virtually empty of knickknacks, books, and collectibles. I wasn't sure if that was in deference to the modern design, or simply because Morgan, who was only about 70 years old, hadn't had time to collect much. The master vampire himself stood with his back to the door, facing the glass. Nadia said, softly, respectfully, "Lige, the entourage from Carrigan House." He glanced back over his shoulder. His dark hair seemed to have grown inches since I'd last seen him, even though that had only been a week ago. It waved around his deep-set dark blue eyes and the long, dark brows that topped them. There were plenty of handsome men in the world and plenty of men with lovely eyes, but Morgan's were different, bedroomy, I'd called them, because his gaze seemed to sink into you, inviting you, tempting you with its depth. That gaze skimmed Nadia, then darkened when he saw Ethan, and clouded completely when he saw me. Morgan had a dramatic personality, but he shuddered the expressions in his face, anger, betrayal, sadness, fast enough. Maybe he was taking to masterdom after all. He turned around. "Thank you, Nadia," he said, and Nadia nodded and left the room. From her deferential reactions, I was getting the sense that Navarre's master occupied a different kind of position than Cadogan's master. Or maybe the deference was just part of being second to a master vampire, being acquiescent until the crown was handed to you. Malik, after all, generally seemed to defer to Ethan. And speaking of Ethan, crown firmly in hand, offered his opening gambit. "Merritt has had no contact with Nicholas Breckenridge regarding the story. No contact at all, in fact, since the incident." Morgan looked at me. "True?" I nodded. He walked toward his desk, then took a seat. Ethan gestured toward the bank of windows. "May I?" "Be my guest," Morgan said crisply. They switched places, which still left me standing between them. Poetic, I thought. "You know that Gabriel visited us after the blackmail was cleared up?" Ethan asked, his gaze on the courtyard below. "I do now. I also know, thanks to the Sun-Times, that you and Merritt apparently paid a visit to a bar in Ukrainian village. Would you care to enlighten me?" Ethan turned around, arms crossed over his chest. I guessed he hadn't been keeping Morgan up to date on our shifter interactions. Not that that was a surprise. He tended to keep details to himself. "Gabriel asked that we be present at a pre-meeting of the Alphas. We obliged." Morgan sat back in his chair and crossed his hands behind his head. "Why did he want you there?" "Security, most fundamentally. He also wanted vampires to be present, individuals who could remind the shifters of the purpose of the convocation." "Mm-hmm," Morgan said, then lifted up a folded copy of the Sun-Times. "It appears you didn't make the best security." Ethan's jaw clenched. "The attack was external. One of the pack leaders walked out. Shots were fired at the bar a few minutes later. It's possible those two things are connected, but Gabriel seems to have doubts. They're investigating." Ethan paused and looked down, as if contemplating how much to tell Morgan. Ethan, I knew, had his doubts about Morgan's temperament, about his ability to stay calm and make the kind of difficult political decisions that needed to be made. I glanced over at Morgan and found his furrowed stare on me, his head tilted to the side. He could have spoken with me silently. Although only a novitiate and the master who made her were supposed to have the ability to speak telepathically, Morgan and I had made that connection when he'd challenged Ethan for an imagined slight against Selena. Maybe he didn't want to speak. He just had his own puzzles to ferret out. Morgan's gaze suddenly snapped back to Ethan. So the wolves invited the sheep into their den. He waved the paper in the air. I'll skip the lecture about the need to keep all of Chicago's masters informed, Ethan, since I doubt it would make much difference. Score one for the newbie master, I thought, even if he was right, and therefore out of luck. A lecture from Morgan wasn't going to stop Ethan from holding back information about his strategy. If we help them, Ethan said, exhaustion in his voice, probably since he wasn't used to having his decisions questioned by those of equal rank. Which we will. We show our willingness to act as a unified supernatural community. We do a favor, and we, perhaps, get a favor in return. If they actually needed you for security, Morgan said, you might have a point. But shifters can take care of their own. Two vamps with swords won't change that, even if they dress her up in slutty leather. I had to work to keep the anger off my face. Ethan could certainly be cold, but Morgan could be downright obnoxious. Your opinion is noted, Ethan said flatly, and we will act as we deem in the best interest of our house. Oh, we're well aware of that, Morgan replied, then flung the paper across the room. Aided by Morgan's vampire strength, it zipped through the air like a frisbee, finally coming to rest at Ethan's feet. Ethan glanced down at it, then raised his gaze to the Navarre master again. Nothing in the article was our doing, he said. We had no idea it was being written, and we have had no communication with the author. He took a menacing step forward, his eyes cold and bright. But more important, he said, his voice an octave lower, none of the information in that article was untruthful. You may wish to hide behind your position as a master, but recall the house from which you arose. Selena is responsible for the death of humans, deaths unrelated to her need for blood. Deaths she apparently undertook because the humans were convenient pawns in her quest for power. You may find denial convenient, but she was master of this house, and this house will bear the burden of the decision she's made, however horrible those decisions, however onerous those burdens. If you want to change the public's perception of the house, then change the house. Make it your house, a house of honor, a house that reaches out to other communities, a house that defends all vampires instead of taking up arms for one who has done us all a disservice by her deeds. A profound disservice, he added. Morgan sat in his chair for a moment, then swallowed. The room was silent, at least until Ethan's cell phone buzzed. He patted the pockets of his suit jacket until he found it, then pulled it out and glanced at the screen. He glanced up at Morgan. May I step outside to take this? Morgan was quiet for a moment. The office door opened and Nadia stepped inside. Liege? She asked. He must have called her telepathically. Ethan needs to take a call. Will you take him to your office?
Certainly, she said.
She smiled and gestured toward the door. Ethan walked out, and she followed suit, then shut the door behind her, leaving Morgan and me alone in his office. Together. I kept my gaze on the floor, trying to will myself invisible. Without preface, Morgan spoke up. How are things between you two? Given the blush on my cheeks, I was glad I'd turned back to face the window, but I ignored the undertone of his question. I think we have a pretty good working relationship. That's not what I meant. No, I corrected, unwilling to answer deferentially when he couldn't manage a civil conversation with me. That's not what you want to hear, but that answers your question. I heard you attacked him. Was that prompted by our conversation? It was prompted by Selena's attacking me on the street. I didn't offer details, assuming Ethan had at least filled him in on his former master's ill-advised return to Chicago. There was silence for a moment, long enough that I glanced back at Morgan. There was regret in his expression. You knew, I guessed, turning back toward him. You knew she was in town, and you didn't tell anyone. And then I remembered what I'd seen when Selena had attacked me. She was wearing a new Navarre medal. She came by here, I said with sudden realization. She came to the house and you saw her. That's how she got the medal. Morgan looked at the floor, his gaze shifting left and right as he prepared his allocution. She built this house, he quietly said. She is my master, and she built my house. She asked for a medal to replace what was taken from her. When he lifted his gaze to mine, I could see the conflict in his eyes. He truly wanted to honor the vampire who'd given him immortality, to do right by her. But I wasn't sure harboring a criminal, master or not, was the way to go about it. And with thoughts like that, maybe I was ready to think about Red Guard membership. Is she still in Chicago? I don't know. I played Ethan, arching an eyebrow back at Morgan. Honestly, he said, both hands raised. I told her she couldn't stay here. I told her I wouldn't report her to the GP, but that she couldn't stay here. And then something interesting happened. There was a sudden glint in his eyes, a sign of master-worthy strategy. But I didn't promise not to tell you. Nice of him to lay that burden on me. But there was nothing to do about it now. Any thoughts on where she is? Morgan leaned back in his chair. Nothing specific, but it is Selena. She loves fashion, elegance. He indicated the office around him. Case in point, this place is practically a museum. An homage to her? He glanced up at me, humor in his eyes, and for a moment I saw the thing that had attracted me to Morgan in the first place. For all that Ethan complained about Morgan's being too human, it was the humanity that sparked his precocious sense of humor and that fueled his compassion for his former master, however undeserved. Something like that, yeah, he said. So if she had decided to camp out in Chicago, you'd expect it to be nice. She wouldn't be sharing a fourplex. You'd have to look for her in Hyde Park, the Gold Coast, Streeterville. Somewhere with a doorman, an elevator, a view. A penthouse. A condo on the lake. A golden age mansion, something like that. But I don't think she'd stay here. Her face is all over the television, and there are just too many eyes on the ground. I wasn't sure I'd bought the argument that she'd travel all the way back to the States to harass me, then take off for Europe again. But then again, Selena wasn't exactly operating by the same rules as the rest of us. Then where do you think she is? Morgan blew out a breath. Honestly, I'd put my money on France. It's where she's from, and staying in Europe keeps the GP and the CPD off her back. My doubts notwithstanding, he had a point. Well, I appreciate the intel. He shrugged. What will you do now? I'll tell Ethan. I wasn't sure what Ethan would want to do, although the fact that there was still a chance, no matter how slim, that Selena was still in Chicago was probably something he'd want to pursue after the convocation. But today we had enough on our plate. Of course you will, Morgan said. And there was the downside of his humanity, that snarky teenage petulance. You might remember that he's my master, so all that deference you show Selena, I show to him. Morgan sat up again, then swiveled in his chair to face the spread of papers on his desk. And I'm sure your relationship is entirely professional, since you always take his side. I take Cadogan's side. That's the point of being sentinel. Whatever, he said. You attacked Ethan. I did. And yet, here you are. He looked me up and down, the gaze I'd once found undeniably attractive, taking on an uncomfortably lascivious bent. No punishment for the teacher's pet. I was punished, I assured him, even if I could agree that being named House Social Chair, even for an introvert, was a light one. On the other hand, Selena was free after a murderous rampage. Maybe vampire punishment standards were just low.
Mm-hmm, he said.
I get that you aren't happy, but can we just try to work together without the snipping? Morgan opened his mouth to retort, but before he got out the words, the office door opened. Ethan walked in, tucking his cell phone into his pocket.
We have some things to take care of, he said, looking between us, if we're done here.
Morgan looked at me for a moment before finally turning to Ethan.
I appreciate your coming by. Perhaps we all need to remember that there are three houses in Chicago, Ethan said, and that those houses are not enemies.
With that, he turned to me and beckoned, and we made our exit. Chapter 11. All in the Family. The Breckenridge Estate, and it was an estate, was located in the rolling Illinois countryside outside Chicago, so we had a drive to get through. Knowing we'd have plenty of time to debrief, I waited until we were in the car before I spilled the Selena beans. Morgan saw Selena before she came to Cadogan, I told him. He gave her a new Navarre medal. She was wearing it when she attacked me. Sad to say, that doesn't entirely surprise me. Any other information?
Morgan doesn't think she's still in town. He's betting she decamped to Europe. But if she's here, he thinks she'd probably be somewhere fancy.
That would fit Selena's sense of self.
As much as I hate to admit it, once Compaq's done, we probably need to start taking some active steps to, I don't know, minimize the damage she could cause.
There's only so much we can do in that regard, given the GP's protectiveness. They chose to release her, after all.
I know, but if the GP isn't going to keep her from riling up the houses and the packs, that's precisely why we need to do some creative thinking.
Perhaps, he said, then paused. It occurs to me that it was a mistake to encourage you to date Morgan. I bit back a smile.
Are you admitting you were wrong?
Only in a manner of speaking. There's a tension between you that we'd have been spared if you hadn't dated. You can hardly stand to be in the same room together.
My stomach twisted a bit at his conclusion, and I wondered whether the next sentence out of his mouth would be something along the lines of, "And speaking of ill-advised relationships."
But if he had concerns about us, he didn't raise them.
"Well, it's water under the bridge now," he said.
You know, you once told me that he was too human. I didn't agree at the time, being recently human myself, but now I get it. He's smart, capable, funny.
Perhaps you should be dating.
Ha, but he can be really juvenile. He's been a vampire for 40 years. He should be past adolescence and midlife crisis.
Sentinel, there are men who've been human for 40 years who aren't past adolescence and midlife crisis.
I gave him the point there. It also occurred to me that I hadn't actually heard Ethan's phone ring.
Did you fake a phone call to leave me and Morgan alone?
I did not, although I thought it would do you both good to clear the air.
I see. Who called?
Catcher, unfortunately. The forensic unit tested Tony's bike. They found gunpowder on the tank, some on the seat.
That won't tie it to the drive-by with 100% certainty. It doesn't look good circumstantially.
Have Tony or his pack taken credit for the hit?
Not that I'm aware of, Ethan said. I plan to ask Gabriel tonight.
Ethan switched on the radio, and we listened to a public station for the duration of the drive. The buildings and parking lots eventually gave way to trees and farmland and to the French chateau perched in the midst of the acres of Breckenridge land. Ethan pulled into the long driveway flanked today by dozens of bikes arranged in two rows. They were an interesting contrast to the Lux mansion, with its chimneys, steep roof, and pale stone. Ethan parked the car at the end of one of the rows of bikes. I hesitated, wondering if I should bring my katana along. I held up the scabbard, the question in my expression.
Bring it, Ethan said, belting on his own sword. If the hit at the bar was a shot at Gabriel, we can't be sure a member of the pack wasn't involved.
Fair enough, I said, and belted mine on as well. We walked the rest of the driveway to the front door. The last time we'd visited, a white-gloved attendant had helped us out of the car, and Mrs. Breckenridge, Nick's mom, had met us inside. Today, our greeter was a little bit different. She pulled the door open forcefully, then propped a hand on her hip. "I got it, Miss B," she called back, then looked at us expectantly. She was tallish and fit and wore a snug t-shirt. Knee-high black boots covered her snug jeans to the knees, and her short nails were tidy and painted glossy black. A dozen earrings dotted each ear, and her wrists were tattooed with tribally inspired bracelets. She had delicately pretty features and Gabriel's same golden eyes, her hair a mass of sun-kissed curls that spilled out from around her shoulders. "Another Keen, I supposed." She gave me a quick look, then shifted her gaze to Ethan. "Sullivan?" Ethan bobbed his head. "And Merritt." "You're in the right place," she said. "Mrs. B said you already jumped the vampire invitation hoop, so she extended your invite for tonight, for whatever." She stepped to the side, holding the door open to allow us entry. "Come on in." Ethan stepped inside. I followed, catching a cloud of citrus and spice perfume as I walked past the girl. "I didn't catch your name," Ethan said. She held out a hand. "Fallon Keen." "Ethan Sullivan," he said, shaking her hand. She turned to me. "Merritt," I said, doing the same. "I'll tell Gabe you're here," she said, then looked at us askew. "Vamps at a pack party. It's definitely a new era." Her tone was open enough that I wasn't sure whether she approved or disapproved of that new era. Ethan's answer wasn't nearly so equivocal. "Let's hope so. Let's hope so." The house overflowed with people and happiness and earthy, peppery magic. Men and women ate and drank and chatted while children ran to and fro amongst them, joy in their expressions, toys in hand. The doors to the elegant ballroom were open, and a long buffet overflowing with food lined one wall. It felt more like a holiday gathering than a last, pre-convocation, supper. "Merritt!" Before I could react, Jeff was in front of me, arms wrapped around me, his lips pressed to my cheek. "We're so glad you're here." I smiled and hugged him back. I assumed his elation had something to do with his crush on me, at least until he reached out to Ethan and gave him the same bone-crushing embrace. Ethan, helplessness on his face, looked to me. I winked back. "This is huge, your being here," Jeff said, releasing Ethan and taking a step back. "Huge! We've never had vamps at a potluck before." "This is quite a potluck," Ethan said, his gaze scanning the crowd. "It's fabulous. You two should get something to eat. Did you meet Fallon?" I nodded. "She met us at the door." "She's Gabriel's sister?" "His only sister, and second in line to the throne, so to speak," Jeff confirmed. "Most of the rest of them are here tonight." He pointed through the crowd at various lion-maned men, all of whom shared the keen, tawny hair. Adam glanced over and waved, dimples perked at the corners of his mouth. Two young boys, plastic cars in hand, suddenly ran between us, leaving vroom noises in their wake. "It's a joyful occasion," Ethan observed. "We're together," Jeff said. "A family come together. That's a good reason for celebration. Even if Conpac means we might leave you." He looked at me with concern in his eyes. "I wouldn't want to leave. I wouldn't want to abandon you." "I know," I comforted, then squeezed his hand. "I wouldn't want you to leave." His eyes went wide, and a crimson blush suddenly rode his cheeks. "In a platonic way, Jeff. A cherished friend kind of way." "Whew," he said, shoulders bobbing in relief. "I actually wanted to talk to you about that." At the blush on his cheeks, I took a guess. "Jeff, is there someone else?" He offered some equivocal ums and uhs, but when his gaze slipped back into the crowd and followed the bobbing curly hair of Fallon Keen across the room, I had my answer. "Does she know?" He looked back at me, and that boyish blush had turned into something much more mature. Of course she does. I have some pretty serious game, Merritt. I leaned in and pressed a kiss to his cheek. I know you do, Jeff. Now, other than your romancing Fallon Keane, what's on the agenda for the evening? Jeff shrugged. This is pretty much it. Reminiscing, enjoying one another's company. Gabe will say a few words later, and food, of course. He winged up his eyebrows. Have you seen the buffet? Only across the room. Jeff clucked his tongue at Ethan. If you're going to do right by her, you better get the girl a plate. With that, he disappeared into the crowd. Ethan and I stood there quietly for a moment. I suppose he's my competition? Then you would be correct. I slid him a glance. Do you have a strategy to woo me better? He smiled slowly, wickedly. I believe I've demonstrated my prowess at wooing you, Sentinel. I humped, but inwardly grinned. The repartee unexpected, and that much more fun. Were we actually together? Was this really happening? Well, I suppose I could follow his advice. Are you hungry? Surprisingly enough, not at the moment. Will miracles never cease? Ha, I said, then scanned the mass of shifters. Parents carried children. Plates were passed among family members and lovers embraced. This is not your typical Breckenridge party. My parents throw all kinds of bashes, said a voice behind me. We both glanced back. Nick Breckenridge, tall, dark, and handsome, stood behind us, hands in his pockets. He wore a dark button-up shirt, the sleeves rolled up, and dark jeans. His hair was Caesar cut, his eyes blue. He had a Roman nose and heavy brow, and he was handsome in the manner of a Spartan soldier, stoically handsome. At the moment, he was keeping a stoic hold on his emotions. We'd see how long that lasted. Ponytailed Avenger? I wondered aloud. Not my idea. I'm assuming the story wasn't either. Nick bobbed his head. The editor originally farmed it out to someone else. I convinced them the story would be a burden to write and took it off their hands. We don't need an enterprising reporter poking around the bar, wondering about the guys in NAC jackets. It was awfully pro-Cadogan House. And pro-Sentinel. I may have rushed to judgment, Nick said. I'm capable of admitting when I'm wrong. But more important, it keeps the focus on vamps. And off-shifters, I finished. He nodded. Understandable. I didn't know you were working for the paper. Just freelance for now, Nick looked between me and Ethan. It's a big deal, your being here. Gabriel's vetting you. We've heard, Ethan said, and we appreciate the opportunity. They were silent for a moment, sizing each other up, I assumed, and debating on whether to make peace or war. Speaking of Gabriel, I said, gesturing to the room, is this a way of mending fences? As you know, I was the prime mover behind some ripples he isn't thrilled about, Nick darkly agreed. But I hope eventually I can regain his trust. This is a step in that direction. As for CONPAC, I don't think the PAC will vote to stay. It is a distinct possibility they'll leave, Ethan said. And if that's the vote that's made, we'll figure out a way to adapt. I wondered if the Brecks would have to adapt as well. From what I'd seen, they didn't seem like the typical shifters. No Harleys and no leather. Instead, they were a family with strong ties to Chicago and stronger ties to their land. If they vote to leave, I asked him, would you go? Pack up Michael and Finn and Jamie and your parents and head north? I can't answer that. I cocked my head at him. Because it's a secret? Because I don't know. There was defeat and guilt in his voice. It was the guilt of a man who wanted to believe, but who hadn't quite decided whether to play follow the leader. Even considering the drama Nick had created for vampires, my heart clenched in sympathy. Doubt was a debilitating, frightening thing. Nick was spared further predictions by the splitting of the crowd. I could see the ripple of people moving in our direction, and then Berna stood before us, having elbowed her way through the shifters, an overflowing plate of food in hand. It brimmed with an assortment of meats and casseroles and vegetables, a steaming yeast roll parked on top like the cherry on a sundae. The shifters around us had quieted and turned their gaze on the two women who stood facing off. Me, the tallish, slender vampire with the dark ponytail and gleaming red scabbard, and Berna, the shortish, roundish woman with bleached hair and gnarled fingers, her arms extended in offering. She thrust the plate toward me. "You eat." I started to object, but the venom in her eyes made me think better of it. "Thank you, Berna. That was very thoughtful of you to bring me a plate." "Hmm," she said, then pulled a fork from the chest pocket of her zip-up polyester shirt. She handed that over, too. I slid Ethan a glance, and at his nod, and to the amusement of the shifters who'd watched the exchange, dipped the fork into a heap of potato casserole and took a bite. My eyes closed as I savored tender potatoes, butter, paprika, and more cream than should probably be allowed in a single dish.
"Oh, Berna, this is amazing."
"Mm-hmm," she said, self-satisfaction in her voice. I opened my eyes to watch her turn on her heel and march away, the crowd swallowing her up again. I speared another bite of casserole, then aimed the fork at Ethan. He regarded it for a moment, but at my own threatening glance, leaned in. Half a second later, his own eyes drifted shut as he enjoyed the bite. "Told you," I said, then took back the fork.
"You have a gift."
"I know, right?" I absently said, but I was already gone, adrift on a sea of carbohydrates. After a bit, Nick merged back into the crowd, and Ethan slipped away to make a call, leaving me in the midst of the pack. That was when Adam made his approach. He was dressed casually, a thin, cotton button-up shirt over jeans, thick boots, and a long chain and Celtic pendant around his neck.
"You two seem to be quite the hit," he said. "Berna doesn't cook for many. I know she appreciates what you did for her."
"I'm just glad I was able to get there in time," I said, then nodded to the crowd around us.
"It seems everyone's having a great time."
"Ah, we usually do. It's the kind of thing we do back home. Big reunions, barbecues, that kind of thing."
"I've heard Gabriel lives in Memphis. Is that where you live as well?" Adam smiled slyly, lips curving, his deep dimples pert. I guess you could have called his smile wolfish, as there was definitely something predatory about it.
"I live wherever I want.
Nomadic or just afraid of commitment?" This time he smiled with teeth.
"You want to try me out?"
I snorted. I have enough problems managing the vampires in my life.
"How do you know shifters wouldn't be easier to manage?"
"It's not about how easy or hard they are to manage. It's about keeping out people who require management. I prefer a drama-free existence."
"Probably shouldn't have become a vampire."
"Didn't exactly have a choice." That stopped him. His smile dropped, replaced by an expression of slightly morbid curiosity.
"Didn't have a choice? I thought vampires had to take oaths.
Consent to the transformation or something." I looked away and moistened my lips nervously. Although the entire city knew I'd been made a vampire, the facts of my change, the fact that I hadn't exactly consented to it, were only known by a precious few. I'd made the offhand remark without thinking, but I sure wasn't prepared to tell this guy the truth, dimples or not. "There were considerations other than the drama," I told him, hoping that would answer the question enough to keep him from asking any more. "It wasn't just about becoming a vampire. It was about staying alive."
"That's true for a number of us."
When I looked at him again, there was something surprising in his eyes. Respect.
"You're a fighter," he concluded, "a warrior of a sort."
"I stand sentinel for the house," I said. "A guard, in a manner of speaking.
A knight amongst kings."
I smiled. "Something like that." And how do you spend your waking hours, Mr. Keene, other than wooing girls with those dimples? He looked down again shyly, but I didn't buy it, especially not when he lifted his gaze again, grinning wickedly. I'm a man of simple pleasures, Miss Sentinel. And what are those? He shrugged negligently, then waved to a man who passed with plastic cups of juice on a tray. Family friendly, I assumed. Adam grabbed two, then handed one to me. Next time we have a drink, I'll make it fancier. What are my chances? I took a sip of warm apple juice. Slim to none. He chuckled good-naturedly. Taken? And not interested? Ouch, he said, drawing out the word. You are a sassy one. I like that. In spite of myself, I smiled. I wasn't tempted by his offer, and as a matter of fact, I was taken, it seemed. But that didn't make it any less flattering. Adam Keene was a lethal combination of good looks, charm, and an undercurrent of wickedness. I'm also a curious one, I admitted. And in the few minutes we've been in here, you avoided every personal question I've asked you. He held up his free hand. Sorry. I don't mean to be evasive. You're a vampire. I'm a shifter. And while I dig that Romeo and Juliet vibe, we tend to be a little on the cautious side when it comes to answering to the fanged. I can understand that, I allowed with a nod. But that doesn't make me any less curious. Stubborn, aren't you? I was hearing that a lot lately. I am, I admitted. Let's try again. What does a shifter like you enjoy doing in your free time? Well, he said, looking at the floor and blinking as he considered. I grill. I do some lifting. I sling a pretty good guitar. I lifted my eyebrows. You sling a guitar? Like you throw one? I had an image of two men in a mixed martial arts cage, beating the crap out of each other with curvy acoustic guitars, wood and strings flying. He chuckled. Sling as in play. I mess around with a 12-string, nothing formal, just something to relax, maybe out on the back deck with a beer, staring up at the stars. That sounds like a pretty nice way to spend an evening. I wondered where that deck was located. Where are you from? I asked again. He paused, fiddling with the edge of his plastic cup, then looked up at me. You were right about Memphis, he finally said. We have a den on the east side, outside the city, so the glare doesn't get in the way of the stars, he frowned. It's weird to be here. You know, great city, lots of stuff to see. And I like the water, but there are no stars. Not many, I agreed. But I haven't really seen too many of them anywhere else, either. I've lived in New York and California. You seem to like concrete. It does seem that way. Although, the idea of sitting out on a deck with a beer in hand sounds pretty good right now, too. That's exactly the point, isn't it? I cocked my head at him. How do you mean? Adam gestured at the room. This, all this. We could all be sitting out on a deck with a beer in hand. Instead of doing that, we're in some fancy house in Chicago, waiting to argue about our future. He shrugged. I'll do what Gabe asked me to do, but I understand the urge to go home. Speaking of the drama, has there been any word from Tony? Is he taking responsibility for the hit, challenging Gabriel? Adam shook his head. Not as far as I know. But that's a question for Gabriel. You know, I think we just had an actual conversation. That wasn't so bad, was it? He raised his hand to his neck. My carotid appears to be intact, so no, it wasn't so hard. We aren't all chomping at the bit to break open a vein, you know.
Well, unless you put me in a room with Ethan Sullivan.
Chapter 12. Pack Up the Moon. Until Gabriel stepped out onto an ottoman in the middle of the Brecks' living room, it seemed, as Adam said, as though we were guests at a family reunion. Until then. Gabriel got the crowd's attention with the fierce whistle that nearly made my eardrums pop. That sound was followed by the cacophonous clinking of 100 silver forks on 100 wine glasses that stopped only when he jumped atop the ottoman and lifted his hands in the air.
"Pack!"
he screamed out, and the room erupted with the sound of 100 voices, yells, hoots, whistles, screams, and howls. And along with the sounds erupted a sudden charge of magic. The air sizzled with the electric buzz of it, all at once life-affirming and frightening. After all, this was a predatory energy that wasn't mine. I itched with the urge to move and nearly jumped out of my skin until Ethan moved close enough to align the sides of our bodies. I wasn't sure if he was moving toward me or away from the pack members around us, but there was something innately comforting about the feel of him at my side. It was calming, something familiar amidst sensations that my vampire sensibilities weren't too keen on.
"Be still," he silently said, expressing not the words of a lover, but an order from master to novitiate vampire to calm herself.
And as if he'd ordered it, my pulse began to slow. Jeff, on his way to the front of the room, paused at our sides.
"He's calling the pack," he explained. "As far as I'm aware, you're the first vampires to witness it."
"In Chicago?" I queried.
"In history," he said, then moved forward.
"We are the pack,"
Gabriel announced, and the shifters began to move together, to cluster toward him. As the back of the room cleared, I saw Nick standing alone at the edge of the crowd, a position I assumed he'd adopted since he was still on the outs with Gabriel. And being on the outs with Gabriel, I guessed, was akin to being on the outs with the pack. The rest of them embraced, arms linked as they tightened into a rugby-like knot. But this time, the magic didn't leak outward. It condensed as they gathered together, only the boundary tangible from our spot at the edge of the crowd. They linked arms in rings around Gabriel, and then the howls began again. Some were consistent, like a four-part harmony of animal sounds. Others were random yips. The sounds rose together in a frantic crescendo. The knitted rows of shifters swang in alternating bands as they sang. Realization struck. These weren't just vocalizations, they were communications, reassurances amongst the pack members that they were together, that their families were safe and that the pack was secure. "It's beautiful," I told Ethan, and considered myself fortunate to be witness to something no vampires had seen before. The calling continued for another 10 or 15 minutes, the shifter slowly disbanding, one ring at a time, until they were separate again. Gabriel stood on the ottoman, hands in the air, his fitted dark t-shirt drenched in sweat. Calling the pack, maybe reining in all that magic, must have been hard work.
"Welcome to Chicago," he said,
smiling tiredly and getting another hoot from the audience.
"Soon enough, we will convene. We will take our collective fate to the packs, and we will decide whether to stay or go."
The crowd quieted.
"The time will come to make that decision," he said. "But that time is not tonight."
He reached down, and when he rose again, held a pink-cheeked toddler in his arms, he pressed a kiss to the child's forehead.
"Our future is clouded, but we will persevere, whatever the outcome. The pack is eternal, everlasting."
He reached down and handed the child back to the outstretched arms of his mother, then rose to face the crowd again, hands fisted on his hips.
"Tonight, we welcome strangers into our midst. We call them vampires, but we know them as friends. They have cared for one of our own, and so we invite them here in friendship tonight."
Gabriel gestured toward us. And in response, the pack members turned to face me and Ethan. Some wore smiles. Others bore expressions of outright distrust and disdain. But even those men and women nodded, begrudging acceptance of the vampires in their midst. Vampires who'd saved one of their own.
"Thank God for Berna," I silently told Ethan.
"Thank God you were quick enough to step forward," he replied.
"All of our lives are intertwined," Gabriel said. "Vampire or shifter, man or woman, our hearts echo the very pulse of the earth. And ours are not the only hearts connected.
He looked at Ethan, then me. Someone handed him a cup, and Gabriel raised it to us.
We offer our friendship.
Ethan's eyes went instantaneously wide, but he shuddered the emotion and offered a humble bow to the shifters around us as they drank a toast.
But we don't convene tonight, Gabriel said. Tonight, we live and breathe and love and enjoy the company of our friends and family. Tonight, he said, winking at me, we eat.
Another 10 or 15 minutes passed before Gabriel padded through the crowd to us, his expression a bevy of emotions. Even the magic around him seemed conflicted.
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to be here, Ethan told him. It was quite a thing to witness.
Gabriel nodded.
You took a risk that not all would have taken.
It was the least we could do, Ethan said. Gabriel looked at me.
You went after her. You risked yourself to get her out of harm's way, to make her safe.
I did what anyone would have done.
You saved a life.
The words were earnest, but there was still something sharp in his tone, something unhappy in his expression.
He seems pretty conflicted about that, I told Ethan.
Are you concerned about something? Ethan asked.
He shook his head.
I will owe Merritt a debt, he said. I've repaid part of it, dealing with the Breckenridges and their unfounded animosity.
We already knew that part. Gabriel had confessed it when he visited Cadogan House. I had no idea what debt he was referring to, but it had something, I thought, to do with family. Whether his or mine, pack or vampire, I didn't know. And I figured there was no harm in asking. What's the debt you'll owe?
I can't reveal that, Sentinel. The future is fluid. I can see the ripples far into the water, but that doesn't mean the future is immutable, that events cannot be altered.
Shifters were different from sorcerers on that point. Sorcerers prophesized whenever they could, although the prophecies themselves were usually hard to understand.
Can you give me a hint? You said something about family. Mine? Yours?
Gabriel looked up and across the room. I followed his gaze to a woman who stood on the edge of it, friends or relations at her side. Her dark hair was loose around her face, her cheeks freshly pink, her hands supporting the swell of her belly. This was Tanya, his wife, and Connor, his child, a future member of the Keen Clan and the North American Central Pack. A future Apex?
I won't be giving away too much, he said, to suggest the safety of my family lies within your sphere of influence.
We were all silent for a moment, the weight of that pronouncement between us. I wasn't sure if I should be flattered that Gabriel deemed me capable of protecting his family, or worried that the responsibility lay on my shoulders.
On the other hand, the pack shouldn't carry the burden of my debts to others.
He swallowed thickly.
I can't make any guarantees about alliances. All I can say is that I won't shut down the idea entirely. That's all I can offer.
And with that simple suggestion, the idea that he might be willing to consider an alliance with vampires, Gabriel Keen made history. Before we go, I said, bringing us back around to current concerns, have you heard about Tony's bike, about the forensic results?
He nodded. I know they found GSR. Have you heard anything from him? Ethan asked.
Not word one. Why?
We wondered if he'd take responsibility for the bar, Ethan said. Maybe try to take an overt stand against you or the convocation. If he was involved, and he's really trying to sway the balance of power, that'd be the logical way to go.
Gabriel furrowed his brow, then shook his head.
We haven't heard from him, and Tony's lieutenant hasn't heard from him either. I assumed he's gone underground to save his ass.
That is a possibility, Ethan agreed. Gabriel's gaze shifted as Fallon waved to him from the other side of the room.
I need to go. I'll see you tomorrow night.
Without another word, he turned and walked back to the bar, leaving Ethan and me staring after him. Ethan didn't wait long before getting to the good stuff.
He may not have offered a formal allegiance, but that is by far the closest we've come.
We're a good team,
I said with a cheeky smile. He humped, but there was a smile on his face. Now that I've gotten us into a pack potluck and maybe dropped an alliance into your lap, I'm going to check out the buffet. You just ate. I gave him a sardonic look. I'm a vampire with a metabolism faster than a speeding bullet. Besides, that plate was all meat and sides. I didn't get dessert.
Go, he said, shooing me with a hand. Go find chocolate.
I smiled grandly, then took off for the giant buffet. It was even more impressive up close than it had been from far away. The food was homemade, from steaming casseroles and roasted vegetables to pink frosted and coconut-topped cakes. I aimed straight for the desserts, picking up a small plate and fork along the way to host my bounty. Trouble came calling just as I put a homemade cookie on my plate.
Vampire, huh?
I looked over at the shifter who'd spoken. He was tall and broad-shouldered, his thick dark hair pulled into a low ponytail and braid. Most of his face was covered by a thick beard.
Yep, I politely said, offering him a smile. Vampire.
He grunted, then leaned toward me, the smells of leather, cheap whiskey, and cigar smoke moving with him.
You think you're so hot, right, little vampire?
Gabriel's willingness to extend friendship to vampires was clearly not a unanimous emotion. But that friendship was on the line, so I kept my raising ire to myself and moved a couple of feet down the table.